Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's November 4th, Tuesday. And let's take a look at the schedule after I turn some of these lights down. That's good. That's good. How's that? Too dark?
No.
Perfect. Great. All right, so schedule's on the right-hand side. I'll clip in here. Okay, I'm clipped. November 4th. Ah, we should be in muscle physiology, but we're not. Maybe today we'll get into muscle physiology. So today's the 4th. The test is a week and a half away, so you got to stay tuned to see what's on the test. I'm not sure exactly what chapters, but it will be 10, sensory, endocrinology, muscle, and maybe not heart, blood, and circulation. I usually have a lot of fun with that chapter. And I don't know how short I can make it. All right, so let's get started with endocrinology. Unless somebody has a question. Who's got a question over the schedule? Anybody got a question on the schedule? That's good, because I'm not sure what I can say about it. Anyhow, anybody have a question about what we talked about last time? Like, what is a hormone? What's the difference between the endocrine system and nervous system? That kind of stuff. So, what is a hormone? I guess we should review that. What is a hormone? What's it a hormone secreted by?
Gland.
Yeah, gland. What kind of gland? You know all kinds of different kinds of glands. Two major classes of glands. You got endocrine and exocrine. Which kind secrete hormones? Endocrine glands. That's right. Ductless glands. So how does a hormone get around your body to have some kind of effect in other places in your body if it does not have a duct? Yeah, it gets absorbed by the blood. Right, it diffuses into the circulatory system, and your blood carries it everywhere in the body. How does it get into the circulatory system? Kind of nice to know. What's the name of the structure where a hormone can enter the circulatory system? It's a kind of blood vessel. What kind of blood vessel?
Capillary.
Yeah, capillary. That's what I was looking for, because capillaries are thin enough, so diffusion can take place through a capillary. And that's the only kind of blood vessel where things can enter or leave, because that's the only blood vessel that's thin enough, that's leaky enough, is a capillary. So if something's in the blood, cannot leave or enter through a vein, can't enter or leave through an artery, can't enter or leave through a arteriole or a venule, because they are way too thick, the wall is too thick. All right, so it's got to be a capillary. All right, so then the hormone goes everywhere in your body, and how is it that it can affect some tissues but not other tissues? Yeah, because some tissues have a receptor for that hormone and others don't. What do we call a tissue that has a receptor for a particular hormone? It is a target tissue, yeah, a target cell. So a target cell is only a target cell if it has a receptor for that signaling compound, which is a hormone. All right, and then the last thing you got to know is after a hormone binds to a receptor, is that it? Is that the end of the story?
No.
How does the story continue? What happens? What happens then after a hormone binds to a receptor? It changes the physiology of the cell that has the receptor, usually working through some kind of protein synthesis or maybe moving proteins around inside the cell, like for insulin, right? It inserts the GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane, but somehow it's going to change the physiology of the cell. Okay, then we looked at pituitary gland, right? Posterior, anterior pituitary, a number of different hormones from the pituitary, and what endocrine gland controls the pituitary gland? What endocrine gland controls the pituitary, in particular the anterior pituitary? Could it be central nervous system? Hypothalamus, yeah. Is that an endocrine gland or is that a part of your brain?
Part of
your brain. Ah, but it's also an endocrine gland, right? Because it secretes hormones that control the anterior pituitary. Green or red? Red. Okay, I'll try to change the battery out again. All right, so the hypothalamus is part of the brain, part of the central nervous system, but it also acts like an endocrine gland because it secretes releasing hormones or releasing factors that cause the release or can trigger the release of hormones from the anterior pituitary. All right, so there is another example of how the control system is really hard to differentiate into either nervous system or endocrine system because sometimes they function as both together. And we call that what? The neuroendocrine system. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to go down to adrenal glands today. And tell me where the adrenal glands are located as I switch batteries out. Oh, I can't switch batteries out because I don't have any batteries. Okay. So it goes. Usually I have plenty of backup batteries, but not today. All right, where do you find the adrenal glands? Yeah, here's the kidney. Then right superior to the kidney, we have the adrenal gland. And like many organs, there's a superficial part and a deep part. What do we call the superficial part? That is the adrenal cortex, and the deep part is called the adrenal medulla. Yeah, and medulla just means deep. Cortex means superficial. And as you can see on this picture right here, these two different locations on the adrenal gland are a lot different from each other. You're familiar with the adrenal medulla because what does it do? What does the adrenal medulla do? Yeah, it acts like the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic outflow pathway. When action potentials reach the adrenal medulla, then the cells of the adrenal medulla secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine outside their cells, extracellularly, and then there are capillaries there that pick up those compounds and deliver them all over the body. So even though you might want to think of norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter, here is a pretty good example of how norepinephrine is used as a hormone, or maybe you want to think of it as a neurohormone. Okay. But we're not going to talk about that today, just maybe a little bit, just review as we did. We're mostly interested in the adrenal cortex. That is an endocrine gland as well. And you can see even the adrenal cortex has some different layers. And I don't think I'm going to ask you much about these layers, except if there is an end of chapter question or an online question, then you should be a little bit familiar with them. But certainly you can see there is a histological change as you go from the capsule, or the connective tissue capsule, down to the adrenal medulla. We have the glomerulosa, the fasciculata, and the reticularis. These layers secrete different kinds of hormones, so let's take a look. Basically, there are two kinds from the cortex. There's cortisol and aldosterone. Cortisol is what we call a glucocorticoid. And when you say corticoid, that means that it's basically a steroid, so it's derived from cholesterol. And glucocorticoid has something to do with regulating glucose metabolism inside your body. So what does it do? Well, it stimulates gluconeogenesis. What is gluconeogenesis? Is that the breaking down of glucose or what? How would you think of that? It's making new glucose. All right, so would cortisol alleviate or exacerbate diabetes mellitus? Diabetes mellitus is when your blood glucose is too high, can't be regulated, stays high. Does cortisol make it worse or better? Worse, right, because it's producing glucose in your body even though you haven't consumed any, right? So cortisol doesn't help somebody that has diabetes mellitus, right? The other thing that it does, not only does it make new glucose, it inhibits glucose utilization. So when there is glucose in the blood, it stays trapped in the blood, right? So cortisol maintains high blood glucose levels. Right, for periods of stress in particular. All right, so cortisol, glucocorticoid. Aldosterone, on the other hand, is what we call a mineralocorticoid. It's a corticoid, and sterone means, again, that it's a steroid, and the base molecule is cholesterol. And what I want you to know is that it has an effect of sodium and potassium levels in your body. And it helps regulate these levels because it can stimulate the kidneys to resorb sodium. But what the heck does that mean? I don't know if you can remember from anatomy. Resorption is moving material from where to where. Resorption is moving material from something that's going to be urine. What do we call that fluid that's going to be urine if nothing happens to it? It's called filtrate, right? So you have filtrate that will eventually become urine. And when sodium is resorbed, that means that sodium goes from filtrate back into the blood, back into your body. That's resorption. Secretion goes the other way. Secretion is when there's a compound in your body and the kidney actively puts it into the filtrate, and then you excrete it from your body when it becomes urine. So that's secretion as opposed to resorption. So when you look at this statement right here, sodium and potassium, do they move in the same direction or do they move in opposite directions under the control of aldosterone? Opposite directions. That might be a little confusing. Certainly it was for me for a couple of decades. Why is it opposite? But nonetheless, you should just remember that it is opposite, because when you take a board exam, you might have a question, what is the effect of aldosterone? Why am I losing my arrow all the time? Where is it? Okay, there it is. They might say, well, it will enhance the secretion of sodium and potassium. Okay, or it might say it will increase the resorption of sodium and potassium. And immediately, you know those two answers are wrong, because sodium and potassium in those answers are going the same direction. But you know what? They're going to be opposite directions, right? So always pick the answer where sodium and potassium are going in opposite directions. The very last week of the class, we're going to look and see exactly why that happens, but I think there's something else that you're really familiar with. And that is, there's another mechanism whereby sodium and potassium go in opposite directions. And that's the whole basis of how aldosterone works. What other thing do you know about where sodium and potassium go in opposite directions? And I even said at one point in time, that's where the majority of energy in your body goes. Action potential is close, but active transport, yeah, because we said it requires energy. What kind of active transport? Sodium and potassium. What about the sodium-potassium ATP pump? Does that make sodium and potassium go in opposite directions? Yes, absolutely so. And that's the whole reason why aldosterone works the way it does, because of that sodium-potassium pump. But we got to get into the urinary chapter before you really can see what's going on there. But so I'm just belaboring the point that aldosterone causes opposite effects on sodium and potassium. Secretion of potassium, but it maintains sodium inside your body. Right? Aldosterone increases sodium because it resorbs it from the filtrate, which will eventually be excreted from your body. Right? The adrenal cortex also secretes some supplementary sex steroids, mostly androgens. So females produce androgens just like males do. Males produce more because gonads and males produce a lot more androgens, but even in females, right, their adrenal cortex does produce some male sex steroids. And of course that's really important because that gives a person sex drive. Okay, sex drive, that's very important for procreation and maintenance of the species. And it also explains aggressive behavior. Right, which gender is more aggressive, males or females? Huh? What? I think I heard males. I go, what? How is that possible? That's obviously not the case. All right? The most aggressive gender are females, okay? Not necessarily males. In what sense? In terms of maternal behavior, protecting their young. There's nothing that's going to be more aggressive than that anywhere in the universe. Okay, and so we would use those androgens from the adrenal cortex to help explain that. All right, so here's the adrenal cortex we see on this slide. You can see the different layers, like the glomerulosa, fasciculata, reticularis. Sometimes these layers work together, for instance, in the synthesis of glucocorticoids. The glomerulosa all by itself produces the mineralocorticoids. And fasciculata and reticularis also work together to make androgens, other like androstenedione and other kinds of androgens. But I think the most important thing about this slide is what's the precursor molecule for all of these, the mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, and sex steroids? Cholesterol, right? And maybe you have a picture in your mind of what all these steroids kind of look like, just that stair-step kind of shape molecules, and then with some minor modifications of hydroxyl groups and methylene groups, or methyl groups, then that small change in structure means a big difference in how these compounds function in your body. All right, adrenal medulla we're familiar with. right? Because you're familiar with the sympathetic nervous system, so this is just one way that a sympathetic signaling molecule can be transported everywhere in your body, and that helps explain what mass activation of your sympathetic nervous system when it becomes stimulated, because epinephrine and norepinephrine go everywhere, not to just one target tissue, but everywhere in your body. Okay. All right, so that's it for the adrenal cortex. We're going to look at those mineralocorticoids and glucocorticoids some more later on in the class. Thyroid gland. What causes the thyroid gland to secrete thyroid hormone? Thyroid stimulating hormone. And where does that come from? The anterior pituitary. And what causes the anterior pituitary to release thyroid stimulating hormone? It's another hormone from the hypothalamus, and that's called TSH, what, TSHRH or TSHRF? I don't really care what you call it. Some books call it one, some call it the other. Okay. So thyroid hormone could either be T3 or T4, and we've looked at the chemical formula of these things. And T4 is transported in the blood. It's converted into T3 when it gets inside of a cell. That's the active form of the hormone, right? There are cytoplasmic receptors, so these hormones move through the cell membrane, and it helps adjust basal metabolic rate. And that's just basically how we use energy in our body, and it's also necessary for growth and development, right? So it has a permissive effect, for instance, with growth hormone. So it's absolutely necessary for that. So the thyroid gland, if we look microscopic, if we look at a histology of the thyroid gland, we see that it has little spherical structures that we call follicles, microscopic spherical structures. All right, there's an outer layer of cells that we call follicular cells. These things synthesize tetraiodothreonine, we're just going to call that T4, and then it's secreted to the interior of a follicle. There's a fluid inside the follicle that's rich in proteins, and that T4, remember, is not really soluble in water very much, so it has to be bound to another carrier-type molecule, which are these proteins. So when you have T4 and all these proteins inside that spherical follicle, we call that a colloid, right? So a colloid is like a suspension of stuff, these proteins with T4 bound to it. So here is an illustration of a follicle. And here is the fluid inside the follicle. What do we call this fluid inside a follicle? The colloid, right? And so these follicular cells will actively transport iodide that's in the plasma into the follicle, right? And then it is oxidized into the form of iodine. Iodine then in thyroglobulin. When you see this globulin, that just means a protein. It has a protein structure. When it combines with iodine, then it can become monoiodotyrosine, and then there can be some other substitutions. It can become diiodotyrosine, and then if we add another iodine on it, then it can be a T3, or if you add two more, right, then it can be a T4. And these things are stored inside the follicle until what happens? It needs a signal for T3 and T4 to be released. What's the signal that it's waiting for? So this is in the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland has receptors for thyroid stimulating hormone, right? So when thyroid stimulating hormone is present and T3 and T4 are secreted into the plasma, they also have to bind to carrier proteins, globulins which transport them, because remember, these are lipophilic, they're not hydrophilic, so they need carrier proteins. We've looked at that before. Oh, here it says, TSH stimulates the hydrolysis of T4 and T3 from the thyroglobulin that's in the colloid, and then it secretes these compounds into the blood. And of course, they go everywhere in the body, binding to cytoplasmic receptors, and then that acts as transcription factors that control protein synthesis inside cells. So let's look at the control mechanism for the thyroid gland and the anterior pituitary, and all these things control thyroid hormone secretion. All right, so here is the anterior pituitary. Let's just start here, anterior pituitary. And it's going to release thyroid stimulating hormone. It's a hormone, so it's in the blood, goes to the thyroid gland, and it's going to have an effect on the thyroid gland, because what does a thyroid gland have? it has receptors, right, for thyroid-stimulating hormone. And the effect, it's a trophic hormone, so the effect is that it causes the thyroid gland to grow, or it causes it not to regress, not to dissolve away, and it also causes it to release T3 and T4 into the blood. Now, in order for T3 and T4 to be competent, right, in order to have the proper shape, what do they have to have? What makes it a T3? What makes it a T4? What's the difference between a T3 and a T4? It's that one iodine atom, right? So in order for thyroid hormone to have any use in your body or to have an effect in your body, it has to have that iodine element bound to it. Three of them if it's T3, four of them if it's T4. And so the thyroid gland is going to secrete these things, and these are going to go all over the body regulating basal metabolic rate. And since they're in the blood, okay, they're going to pass through the anterior pituitary, and the anterior pituitary even has receptors for T3 and T4. And so as the concentration of T3 and T4 increase, what happens to the anterior pituitary? I see a little minus sign. The anterior pituitary knows what the set point is, right? And if the levels of T3 and T4 start to rise above the set point, then it's going to tell the anterior pituitary to stop secreting so much thyroid-stimulating hormone, right? And that's going to decrease T3 and T4 back down to the set point. So this is what kind of feedback mechanism? Oh, it says right there. That's not so tough. Nice negative feedback mechanism, right? So that is the case. If there are proper levels of iodine inside your body, because that's necessary to have competent T3 and T4. Now, can your body make iodine? It's an element, right? Your body can't make it. It's made by a really weird process. A star has to supernova to make an iodine molecule. Okay? That hasn't happened around here in a really long time. Right? But there still is enough iodine on the planets that we can absorb it, put it in our thyroid gland. But if we don't have iodine in our diet, then we can't make it, and we're going to be deficient. So the thyroid gland is going to make T3 and T4 without the iodine on it, and it's not going to work like a hormone. The thyroid gland will secrete it, okay? But when it secretes it, right, it won't bind to the receptors in the anterior pituitary saying that the thyroid gland is busy doing something and secreting thyroid hormone. So even though the thyroid is secreting something that looks like T3 and T4, it's not the exact right hormone. So it can't participate in this negative feedback loop. So if the thyroid gland is really busy making an incompetent form of T3 and T4, right, the anterior pituitary won't know that. Right, T3 and T4 will go below the set point, so what will the anterior pituitary do when it does not see proper levels of T3 and T4 in the blood because you don't have iodine in your diet? Will it cut back on thyroid-stimulating hormone or increase the levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone? It increases TSH, which causes the thyroid gland to grow and try to produce more T3 and T4, but it can't because you don't have iodine in your diet, right? And so this feedback loop, right, will continue and continue. The thyroid gland will get bigger and bigger and bigger, but it can never make a good thyroid hormone because there's no iodine in your diet. All right, so the negative feedback disappears. The anterior pituitary secretes excess thyroid-stimulating hormone, and of course, the thyroid gland will recognize thyroid-stimulating hormone because it still has receptors. It gets busy and starts growing, right, to make thyroid-stimulating hormone. But even though it gets bigger, can it make thyroid hormone without iodine? It can't. It only gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, but it can't make any thyroid hormone because there's no iodine in your body. And so when the thyroid gland gets really big like this, you can see it in people sometimes. Okay, that's what we call goiter. And maybe every once in a while, I haven't seen this in a whole bunch of years, but sometimes I'll see somebody on the street and they have this big mass on their neck. Okay, and if it's bilateral, that means that both of these lobes, right, the right and left lobes of the thyroid gland are being told to grow and secrete thyroid hormone. Right, and that's what we call a goiter. Right. Now, if you see somebody with an enlarged thyroid gland, but it's only on one side, unilateral, then that's probably a tumor of some kind, right? That's not goiter, and that might cause even more concern, right? But if it's bilateral, then both lobes are behaving the same way because it's being stimulated by excess thyroid-stimulating hormone. Right, so just by casual inspection, sometimes you can tell what's going on there. Right, who's got a question about goiter? What's a basic reason why somebody has goiter or a goiter? A deficiency of iodine. And a really easy treatment for that is just to provide iodine in somebody's diet, and they can recover from that very quickly. Okay. And where do we get most of our iodine from? Yeah, mostly from table salt that we have. Unless maybe you're a health food fanatic. I'm just kidding. That's okay to be a health food fanatic to some degree. They don't have iodized salt, right? So you have to make sure that you get iodine someplace. Otherwise, you'll end up with? Well, you'll have, yeah, goiter. Hyperthyroidism might not be a really good description of goiter because hyperthyroidism means that you're secreting excess levels of T3 and T4. But when somebody has goiter, there's no T3 and T4, or very low levels of T3 and T4. So there's a subtle distinction right there. Okay. Within the thyroid gland, and there are a couple other glands. Parathyroid glands. All right, I don't have a picture of these. All right, they're associated with the thyroid gland. Parathyroid has to do with calcium metabolism, not growth and development like thyroid hormone does. But the parathyroids secrete parathyroid hormone, and it has a couple of different effects. It has effect on bone to cause bones to dissolve away, right, to break down, and then bone will release calcium into the blood, and that's going to increase calcium levels, right? So when blood calcium decreases, the parathyroids have receptors and can secrete parathyroid hormone to bring calcium back up to the set point. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism, all right? So in this sense, we see that bones are a reservoir for calcium, but do you necessarily want to dissolve your bones away? No. Okay, but you need calcium for synaptic transmission, for muscle contraction that we're going to look at in the next chapter. So, I don't know. What would be your choice? To have really strong bones and not have a nervous system, or not have muscles that work, or to have weaker bones and have a nervous system that works and muscles that contract? Yeah, you'd probably rather have strong muscles that work and a nervous system that works, right? Synaptic transmission. And so that's one of the reasons why, as we get older, we're all going to suffer from a disease where our bones get smaller and more brittle because they're lacking calcium, and that's called osteoporosis, right? Because there are other more important areas in your body that need calcium just besides your bones. But how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? I don't think I mentioned this. Maybe I mentioned this. But you need to work on your bones when you're younger. Okay. And even, I suppose, when you're older, you can still use these tactics. And there's three things you have to do to maintain calcium in your bones. And it's horrible. It's the reason why people hate this class. Okay. Exercise. Yeah, you have to exercise. You've got to put stress on bones, because when bones are stressed, they get bigger and stronger, too. Then calcium is deposited in bones. So you got to stress a bone. And you also have to have calcium in your diet. That's not so bad, but anytime you think about diet, then, you know, Americans don't like to deal with diet very well either. Diet and exercise are like the two worst things that we do well in the United States. But in terms of diet, you need calcium, but you need something else in your diet. You need vitamin D, right? You need vitamin D to absorb calcium that is in your gastrointestinal tract. And then you need calcium there so that it can be absorbed. And then you need exercise to put that calcium into bones to make them stronger and bigger, so that when we start to lose calcium from bones, a big, strong, healthy bone can afford to lose calcium before it gets brittle. Right? And that's typically why guys don't suffer from osteoporosis quite as early in life or as significantly, because their bones are a little bit bigger to start with. Right, And for women, that that diet and exercise is really important, especially postmenopausally, when sex steroids take a whole different profile in women. Right? Not so much for men. All right. So what else do parathyroids do? Parathyroid hormones, we see increases blood calcium levels by dissolving bone, but that signal also goes to the kidneys and it stimulates the resorption of calcium. Now, we talked about what that is. What is resorption? Think of two different fluid compartments. One is blood, and what's another fluid area in the kidney? Yeah, you could say urine. And what's the what happen? How does urine get to be urine? There's a fluid that comes before urine. That is what we call filtrate, right? So filtrate, that's the fluid that's being processed into urine. So parathyroid hormone, right, causes resorption of calcium, which means that it takes calcium from the filtrate and puts it back in the blood. And so that increases, right, blood calcium, which decreases urinary excretion of calcium. So that's parathyroid hormone. Parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium. And as you can imagine, is that an important process, do you think, or maybe not so important? Adjusting blood calcium levels? Is synaptic transmission important? Yeah. So under with some of these really important parameters in your body, what kind of control are they under? Are they under tonic control or antagonistic control? What would be a better system? What about your car? Would you like just to have a gas pedal or just a brake pedal, or would you like to have both that work against each other? Yeah, so antagonism is super important. So the same thing for blood calcium levels. Parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium. There's another hormone that decreases blood calcium, right? And that's called calcitonin. Calcitonin also comes from the thyroid gland, right? So it's the balance of those two hormones. And so there are some imbalances we get older to where we can't really maintain proper blood calcium levels. There's some imbalance right there that has to do with also osteoclasts and osteoblasts. What can you tell? What's the relationship between an osteoclast and osteoblast? What does an osteoclast do? What's an osteocyte? Ooh, what's an osteocyte? It's a cell, right? Yeah. What does osteo mean to you?
Bone.
It means bone. So it's a mature bone cell, right? Osteocyte. All right, so what are these other two cells that I was talking about? Like an osteoblast. What's an osteoblast? It's a bone cell that builds bone, and an osteoclast is a bone cell that breaks bone down, right? And so they're antagonistic to each other, right? So they're controlled, their activity somehow is controlled by parathyroid hormone and calcitonin. Okay, so it's a nice antagonistic mechanism. Yes?
I know that sometimes during surgery,
yes,
of the thyroid,
okay,
then we remove parathyroid.
Ah, okay.
So if the parathyroid hormone has an effect on the calcium to bone, what will happen to a person that was being removed?
I don't know if they need replacement therapy or not. I'm just not familiar enough. What happens if somebody loses their parathyroid glands early in life? I'm not really sure. I'm not sure. I should look into that. Google that a little bit. Yeah, it probably has some relatively important effect. I don't know how it's dealt with. I don't know if you can just deal with it by diet or if there's other things that you have to do. I'm not sure. But a good question. Yeah, then they can't be replaced. They don't grow back if they're removed. Okay. Islets of Langerhans. We're going to switch hormones. Does anybody know where the islets of Langerhans are? In the pancreas. Fantastic. All right, so here is the pancreas. In anatomy, you learned all these nice structures, right? Like here's the tail, here's the head, main pancreatic duct. All right, here's the common bile duct. But we're mostly, so we see a bunch of ducts in the pancreas. So we know what kind of gland is the pancreas, because I see all these ducts. That's an exocrine gland, right? So that's not part of the pancreas that we're going to be interested in right now. The exocrine part produces digestive enzymes, and of course they have to be transported to the digestive tract where they have an effect. And as a matter of fact, maybe the pancreas produces these digestive enzymes in an inactive form, and when they're transported to the digestive tract, then they're activated to where they can start breaking various compounds down, like lipids and proteins and things like that. All right, so those digestive enzymes should not be activated within the pancreas, because what would happen to the pancreas then? Then it will digest itself. Right? And there are conditions when that happens, like pancreatic cancer, pancreatitis, and you can imagine those are really nasty kinds of maladies to have, particularly tough to treat. Right? So that's the exocrine part of the pancreas, but there's also an endocrine part. There are cells in the pancreas that don't secrete a signaling compound into a duct, right, but just into the extracellular space. And then from the extracellular space, where do these hormones go? Into a capillary, into the blood, and then they travel around all over the place. We're going to look at two kinds of these cells. There are alpha and beta cells, and these islets just refer to like little islands between the places that make digestive enzymes. So they're called the islet of Langerhans. Langerhans was some guy or gal, I'm not sure, who first described these things. And the alpha cells secrete a hormone called glucagon, and the beta cells secrete a hormone that we talked about already, insulin. Okay. All right, so here are two hormones. What do you think the relationship is between glucagon from alpha and insulin from beta cells? They're antagonistic to each other because it's very important to control, right, blood glucose levels. All right, so let's see what we have here. Alpha secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. So the effect of glucagon is to increase blood glucose when it's low. When is your blood glucose typically low if you're a healthy individual? When is blood glucose low? Your choices are when you're in a fed state or you're in a fasted state. When does blood glucose drop? Fed or fasted? When you're in a fasted state, right? So when you're a fasted state, blood glucose starts to drop. But there are receptors for glucose in the pancreas. When they start to drop, pancreas will release glucagon from what kind of cells? The alpha cells, right? And then glucagon stimulates glycogenolysis, right? That means what? Chopping off of glucose from glycogen, putting it in the blood. And also lipolysis, the breakdown of lipids. And then those fatty acids can be used to make ATP. Can't be used to make glucose, but certainly it's a precursor for a lot of energy, other energy molecules in your body, and they increase blood glucose as a result. So glucagon increases blood glucose levels, right? And that's under a nice negative feedback control mechanism. But if you're in a fed state, then blood glucose increases, right? Because we have glucose in our diet, and then the pancreas sees rising levels of blood glucose. So what is it going to do to maintain homeostasis? It's going to cut back secretion of glucagon, increase secretion of insulin. All right, and so what does insulin do once again? It has that really nice fancy tyrosine kinase receptor. A nice simple way I think about insulin is that it's a passport, right? It allows glucose to enter most cells in your body. And without it, that would be like you trying to get into another country without a passport. It just won't happen, right? Okay, so the beta secrete insulin in response to high blood glucose, and when insulin is there, glucose can leave the blood and enter cells, and when it enters cells, then of course the concentration in blood decreases back to the set point. And it also promotes the conversion of glucose into glycogen and fat, and in so doing, right, then blood glucose levels decrease. So this is probably an exam figure. So what's the stimulus with this particular figure? What's the stimulus? Because let's always think in terms of a response loop. How does a response loop always start? With a stimulus. How does it end? With a response. So what is the stimulus? Increased blood glucose. All right. Under those conditions, right? you should be familiar that the beta cells in the pancreas will increase insulin secretion. That will increase cellular uptake in the blood. All right, and when glucose leaves the blood to go inside the cells, then of course blood glucose decreases. All right, and what is this decrease in blood glucose called? Is this the stimulus or a response? That's the response. How does it relate to the stimulus? It subtracts from it, so now you know what kind of feedback mechanism this is. This is a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so when glucose is taken up from the blood, glucose can be converted into glycogen in liver and skeletal muscle. We're familiar with that. And in other kinds of tissues, like adipose tissue, glucose can be used to make triglycerides. Right? And because what do you need for a triglyceride? You need glycerol. How do you go from, how many glycerols can a glucose make? If you just snip glucose in half, you can get two glycerol molecules, right? And then glucose can also be used to make fatty acids. Those can be combined to make a triglyceride. And so that's just a really nice way of storing energy inside your body. All right, so that's what insulin can do. And so just be aware of insulin and glucagon as being antagonistic to each other. So what kind of hormones have we looked at just today that are antagonistic to each other? Insulin and glucagon. What's another pair? Parathyroid hormone and calcitonin. And I can't remember if there's another one that we talked about. That's good for now. Okay. All right, so that's the endocrine chapter. I think if you look at those exam figures, then it's going to be a whole lot easier to memorize all these different hormones and where they come from. Right, like that, which is a really handy diagram. Ah, this one right here, that's an exam figure, right? A lot of information here, but this figure just simplifies it very nicely for you, right? Puts a nice picture in your mind. Okay, so FSH and LH, we're going to talk a lot more about when we get to the reproductive system. So we've covered all these things pretty well, except for the gonadotropins, which we certainly will do in a little bit. Okay, who's got a question about the endocrine system? I don't see anybody. And you know what? I want to talk just a couple more things about the endocrine system. Here is one of the first PowerPoints that I showed you that shows you a bunch of endocrine glands, right? So you know it's a ductless gland. But there are some, not on this slide. All right? Oh, but there is one here. Kidney. Okay, kidney is an endocrine gland. When we get to the cardiovascular chapters, we'll see exactly what it does. We didn't talk about it today, but it secretes a hormone and it helps control red blood cell production. So even though you don't commonly think of the kidney as being an endocrine gland, it does secrete a hormone, helps regulate red blood cell production. So not only does it produce urine, all right, it also produces a hormone, so it is in a sense, a endocrine gland as well. The heart secretes a hormone that helps regulate blood pressure. And so the heart is an endocrine gland as well. Not shown on this slide, but through this class you'll see that it is an endocrine gland. Parts of the digestive tract, small intestine, and stomach secrete hormones. So the stomach and small intestine are endocrine glands as well. All right, so you really have to keep an open mind. But just remember what the basic definition of an endocrine gland is and what a hormone is, okay, when we talk about these other kinds of systems. Okay, and some endocrine glands are in the brain. Like the, what endocrine gland is inside the brain? The hypothalamus, yeah, pineal gland. Okay, so there are various glands there. All right, so I'm going to end this show. Go to muscle. So let's look at muscle. You're kind of familiar with some of the basics of muscle because you have all had anatomy class. So I'm not going to spend too much time talking about anatomy of muscle, just a little bit really fast, because we're interested more in how muscle works and how it's controlled and something about what makes muscles different from other muscles. So let's start by thinking about what's the function of muscle? What is it specialized to do? What is muscle specialized to do? What can it do? It contracts. That's right. It shortens. So it can't push on anything. It can only pull. And if you have a muscle and it's attached to one bone on one end and another bone on the other, when it's stimulated and the muscle contracts, then those two bones get closer together. All right, so that's one important function of muscle. And what kind of muscle specifically is attached to bone? Yeah, skeletal muscle is attached to your skeleton, right? That hence its name. And you know that's under voluntary control. You have control where your skeleton goes, right? But how many other kinds of muscle do you have? Skeletal is one general kind. How many other general kinds do you have? Yeah, you got two. You got cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. So remember, skeletal muscle is an effector organ in the somatic nervous system. Cardiac and smooth muscle are effectors in the, what kind of nervous system? Autonomic nervous system, right? So autonomic nervous system, cardiac, smooth muscle, and glands as well. Okay. So when we look at this muscle right here on this slide, what kind of muscle are we looking at? And how are you going to convince me? How do you know this is smooth or cardiac or skeletal muscle? Okay, I see striations right here. That's a pretty good hint, but you know, if you see striations, it could be two of the three. It could be cardiac and skeletal muscle, or skeletal muscle, all right? So that's not a really dead giveaway. Well, you know that it's not smooth muscle if it's striated. That's the only thing you know by that, but what else would you know? It's attached to a bone. So it's got to be skeletal muscle under voluntary control, right? Controlled by your somatic nervous system. And so here's a whole muscle, maybe like the biceps brachii or coracobrachialis or whatever. And you can see that there are bundles of things inside of a muscle. Those bundles are what we call fascicles, right? And inside of a fascicle, right, you have these individual things. These are the cells. This is a muscle cell. Another name for a muscle cell is a fiber because they're really long and narrow. They're not branched. And all of these things have connective tissue layers around them, like the connective tissue around the whole muscle is what we call the epimysium, right? It's right on the surface of the whole muscle. Around fascicles, what do we call things around fascicles? Around fascicles. Okay, around fascicles, what are we going to call that? Okay, it's either going to be perimysium or endomysium. Okay, perimysium is around a fascicle. Endomysium is around every single muscle cell. All right, so these connective, I think this maybe is important to see. All of these connective tissue layers all merge together at the terminus of a muscle, either the origin or insertion, and it's really not possible to tell the difference between endomysium, epimysium, perimysium, because they all fuse together and forms a tendon which inserts into a bone. Right? And so when that just means that when a single muscle cell contracts, not only does it pull on the endomysium, it pulls what? On the perimysium and epimysium, everything together by the time that tension gets to the end of a muscle. All right, so they just all fuse together right before it forms a tendon which inserts into a bone. All right, so know the building block of muscle. So if we have a muscle, we can break a muscle down into fascicles, right? And we can break fascicles down into muscle cells, which we call fibers, right? And then so here is a muscle cell, and you see things inside of a muscle cell. Okay, so here's the cell. And here is the sarcolemma. Sarcolemma is just another name for the cell membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. Do you see any structures inside that skeletal muscle cell? I see all of these long tubes, right? And these long tubes are what we call myofibrils. So myofibrils make up a cell. And then if we look inside a myofibril, do we see structures inside a myofibril? Oh, look at these myofilaments right here. All right, so how would you build a myofibril? You need myofilaments, okay? And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, what do we get? We get a fiber, and if we put a bunch of fibers together, we get a fascicle, and if we put a whole bunch of fascicles together, we get a muscle, all right? So kind of know what the building blocks are for these various items. Okay, so we're going to be really interested in these filaments right here. As a matter of fact, you could probably tell me two important myofilaments in anatomy. You had to learn two of them. Actin and myosin, right, are myofilaments, and probably these are the thick ones that we're looking at on this slide. And so the thick ones we know are called myosin, and the thin ones are what we call actin. Okay. Okay. So sarcolemma is the cell membrane. So here's skeletal muscle. A nice dead giveaway is that you see these striations, and skeletal muscle is multinucleated because at one time it was a whole bunch of really short cells that fused together to make this one really long fiber. So it's multinucleate. And the striations are due to the internal machinery that allows this fiber to shorten or to contract. And we're going to talk about that. It is just a repeating unit. Oh, here, we see it. It's a repeating unit over and over and over and over again. I see kind of a narrow dark line, and it goes over to this other narrow dark line. This is the structural and functional unit of contraction. If we understand how this thing operates, we know how everything inside a muscle operates. And it's not labeled on the slide, so this is a great question. What do we call this thing between these really thin, dark little lines right here? This is the structural and functional unit of contraction. And it is a sarcomere, right? Exactly right. So we're going to look inside of a sarcomere in a little bit. Right, after we look at the neuromuscular junction. So here we see, what are we looking at? Here's the sarcolemma. So this is just a highly zoomed in region of a cell. Right, so these tubular things that we're looking at right here, right, are not cells. Right, so because here's the cell right here. What is the organelle for contraction inside of a fiber? Here's that organelle. But I want you to be able to name this organelle. I see some other organelles, like this is probably, this maybe is a nucleus or maybe a mitochondria, probably a nucleus. Right, but there's also got to be a lot of mitochondria. Oh, here's mitochondria. Okay, a lot of mitochondria. But here, this is not mitochondria, this is not a nucleus, but it is an organelle. It's an organelle for contraction, and that's what we call a myofibril. Is it labeled on here anywhere? It's probably labeled, I just don't see it. So here's a myofibril. Think of that as an organelle, right? And every muscle cell has many myofibrils that will cause that cell to shorten or to contract. Okay. So here we see a neuron coming down, and here is the synapse between the neuron and the skeletal muscle cell. And so you should be able to tell me what kind of neuron this is by its function, and also by its shape, but by its function. What kind of motor neuron is this? Yeah, somatic, right? Because it's part of the voluntary nervous system. Here's a nice Schwann cell. Here's like a little node of Ranvier. Notice that the axon terminus is extensive for the neuromuscular junction. It's just, and a neuromuscular junction is just a synapse between a somatic motor neuron and a single muscle cell. So you can see it's highly branched, it's extensive, and each of these termini, here's a little swelling. Each of these swellings contain vesicles with neurotransmitter. And I think you should already know what kind of neurotransmitter is secreted at the neuromuscular junction. Acetylcholine, and only acetylcholine. And then there are going to be nicotinic receptors, right, in the neuromuscular junction. So when acetylcholine binds to a nicotinic receptor, what always happens? Excitation, because it causes depolarization, right? So anytime there's a nerve impulse that reaches the neuromuscular junction, it's always going to cause excitation of the skeletal muscle, which means contraction. A skeletal muscle can never come up with any other kind of decision. All right, a little something different that's happening on this skeletal muscle cell compared to another neuron. Okay, so what kind of potential is produced by a nicotinic ligand-gated channel. What is the effect of stimulating a nicotinic ligand-gated channel? What does it do to the cell membrane? Does it change the voltage on the cell membrane? Well, it opens a sodium channel, so sodium rushes in. So what happens to the cell membrane? It depolarizes. Right. Okay. Sorry. I had to lead you there and I forgot what the point was that I want to. Oh, okay. Here's the point. So there are ligand-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction. And what kind of potential change is that when a ligand-gated channel is excited? What kind of potentials are you aware of? What are the two major kinds of potentials? Well, you got resting membrane potential, but let's not think about that one. But what are two other kinds of things? How about graded potential and action potential, right? Graded potential, action potential. So when a nicotinic receptor is stimulated and it opens up a sodium channel, is that an action potential or a graded potential? Okay. Ligand-gated channels produce graded potentials, right? And on a neuron, where are these located? Where are graded potentials located? Dendrites and cell bodies, okay? Can a dendrite and cell body produce an action potential? No, they can't, because why not? Why can't a dendrite or cell body produce an action potential? Because what do you need for those? You need voltage-gated channels, yeah, okay? All right, the other thing you should probably remember, what's one big difference between a graded potential and an action potential? How do they move is what I'm thinking about. A graded potential travels how? It travels with decrement, which means the signal goes away, it dies away as a graded potential moves over the cell membrane. But what about an action potential? Without decrement. You get an action potential on one part of an axon, and it's the exact same action potential even though it's a million miles away, right? Same action potential no matter where you look. So here's a big difference between a dendrite and cell body on a neuron and the neuromuscular junction. Not only are there ligand-gated channels, nicotinic receptors, for acetylcholine, but even within the neuromuscular junction, there are voltage-gated channels. So that means that any time, right, there is a depolarization under the neuromuscular junction, right in this area, what is stimulated besides a graded potential? An action potential right here, which means what? That action potential then will travel over the whole muscle cell, right? So anytime there is stimulation from the somatic motor neuron, it always results in an action potential which travels over the whole surface of the skeletal muscle cell because there are voltage-gated channels everywhere, even underneath the neuro or even within the neuromuscular junction. And can you see that's really a big different step, a radical difference between a synapse and a neuron and a synapse here between a muscle and a neuron? Because if it's a neuron-neuron synapse, you don't have voltage-gated channels until you get where? Way down by the axon hillock, or axon. It's nowhere near the synapse, right? Not so for the neuromuscular junction. And that's why skeletal muscle just always contracts when you send an electrical impulse to it. The other big difference is that there are some structural differences. Here I see invagination of the axon terminus into the surface of the skeletal muscle. And this just helps anchor the neuron to the skeletal muscle. That doesn't happen in a neuron-neuron synapse because when the postsynaptic neuron is excited, it doesn't contract. It doesn't pull away from the presynaptic neuron. But if this is a skeletal muscle, right, when it contracts, it will want to pull away from the somatic motor neuron, and this just helps make sure that the neuron and muscle don't rip apart from each other when the muscle contracts. That's the other kind of big difference. So here's a nice electron micrograph. You can see some individual muscle cells. Here you can see a nice myelinated axon. And look how extensive this axon terminus is. This neuromuscular junction is huge, and a huge amount of acetylcholine is released. There's a huge amount of ligand-gated nicotinic channels And there are voltage-gated channels, so this skeletal muscle has no choice but to contract when a nerve impulse comes down. Okay, and there is no other antagonistic neuron that comes down. So this is what we call the motor end plate, the specializations, and just the extensiveness of the axon terminus. All right, so what is a motor unit, and why are we interested in knowing something about a motor unit? So here I see a single motor neuron, and it comes down over here and it bifurcates, and actually I see it bifurcating into three different pathways. So this is, I suppose you could call this a trifurcation. All right, so when a nerve impulse comes down this axon, which one of these muscle cells are going to contract? So here's one, here's one, here's one, here's one, here's one, here's one. Right? So these aren't myofibrils or anything, these are individual muscle cells. Which one of these muscle cells are going to contract? Or are any going to contract? When an action potential reaches this axon terminus, huge amount of acetylcholine is released, right? Huge amount of nicotinic receptors. It's always going to psych this muscle cell. It's going to contract. But what about this one? Yes, this one, and this one as well. Okay, so this is what we call a motor unit. It's one single somatic motor neuron and the individual muscle cells that it goes to. Sometimes it might be 3, sometimes it might be 100. So sometimes when there's a nerve impulse on this one neuron, only 3 fibers contract within a muscle. Sometimes maybe 100 or maybe 1,000 will contract. Which one will produce a stronger contraction? A motor unit with a lot of muscle cells attached to it or fewer muscle cells? Yeah, one with more muscle fibers attached to it will produce a stronger contraction compared to one that only has 3. All right, so on the top right here, I see a motor unit as well because there's only one nerve fiber and you can see it going to many, many different muscle fibers. Okay, so a nerve impulse, an action potential, remember, is an all or none response. When a muscle contracts, when a skeletal muscle contracts, it contracts to 100% of its ability as well. This one muscle cell is going to contract or it's not going to contract. And when it does, to 100% of its ability. But let's just say that this is a biceps right here. You know that when you lift something up, you can produce a strong contraction or a relatively weak contraction. Right? If you're going to lift something really heavy up, you need a very strong contraction to lift a very heavy muscle. But if you're going to lift a pencil up, you don't use that same amount of energy or force to lift the pencil up. So here's a question I have. If every muscle fiber contracts to a maximal amount of its strength, how is it that when you pick something up, you can use a lot of force or just a little bit of force to lift something up, depending on how heavy it is? How is it possible for you to have a graded response in muscle contraction if every muscle cell, there is no graded response? It's all or none. It contracts with 100% of its ability or none at all. How is it that you can produce a little bit of a contraction or a really strong contraction if every single muscle cell contracts maximally when it's stimulating? And we, right, go back to our understanding of a motor unit. When a nerve impulse goes down to a muscle, not all of the motor units, right, are activated. Maybe only some of them. If some motor units are activated, then each of these muscle fibers will contract to 100% of their ability, but there are still many muscle fibers within that muscle that stay relaxed, and then they don't contribute to that contraction. So if you want a really weak contraction, then you send nerve impulses down just through one motor unit. If you need a stronger contraction, then nerve impulses are sent down through 2 motor units. And if you need a maximal contraction, then you need to send nerve impulses down all of the nerves that go to all of the muscle fibers within a muscle, and that produces a maximal contraction. Okay? And so we just call that recruitment of motor units. So depending on how heavy the object is, okay, then different motor units will be activated or recruited to produce a stronger muscle contraction. So we call that recruitment. Sometimes we talk about the innervation ratio. That tells us the number of muscle fibers that are innervated by one motor neuron. So it's always going to be what? One motor neuron to how many muscle fibers it contracts. So which one will produce a stronger contraction? Innervation ratio of 1 to 100 or 1 to 2,000? 1 to 2,000, right? How many times? 100 times? 200 times more force, right? Depending on that innervation ratio. And if you want even a stronger contraction, then you need to recruit more motor units, right, to produce a stronger contraction. All right, so the 1 to 2,000 produces a strong contraction, but what about dexterity? What about fine control? Maybe you have a part of your body where you don't need a lot of dexterity. For instance, your back muscles. You don't really do much with your back muscles except sit up straight or walk around. But you might have another part of your body where you need a lot of fine manipulation. What part of your body do you need to have fine manipulation? Like maybe muscles that you use for speech or in your hand, okay? So what kind of innervation ratio would you have there? Like 1 to 100 or 1 to 2,000? Yes, so you have 1 to 100 where every motor unit produces a very fine contraction, which means you have much finer control of where your skeletal system is going in that part of your body. Okay, so fine control occurs where motor units are small, right? One motor neuron to a small number of muscle fibers. And that all depends on what is necessary to control those different parts of your body. All right, and here we talked about recruitment already. Structure of a muscle fiber. I think you're familiar with this. Okay, so here's the sarcolemma. The sarcolemma we find surrounding what? What do we, the muscle cell or muscle fiber? So here's a muscle cell, but I'm confused. I see here's a cell. Is it possible to have a cell with more than one nucleus in there? Is that possible? For muscle, it is, right? So don't get tricked on that. Skeletal muscle cells are multinucleate, and that's because at some time during development, there could have been 100 or thousands of short myocytes that join together to form this really long fiber, and all those nuclei are still present. All right, and then here is the organelle for contraction, which we call the myofibril. I don't see mitochondria in here, but of course you know that there are mitochondria. Here is a region let's look through the sarcolemma, really thin dark line to this really thin dark line over here. And I see some darker bands on the inside. I see some light bands on the inside of this thing. What are we going to call this thing here? That is the structural and functional unit of contraction. That's the sarcomere. And if we know how the sarcomere contracts just this one here, we know how that whole muscle contracts, right? And skeletal muscle looks striated because the sarcomere line up perfectly from one myofibril to the next, and even from one muscle fiber to a neighboring muscle fiber. So when you look at it, everything lines up just perfectly, and you see those striations. All right, so here's that myofibril, and of course there are structures inside the myofibril that we call myofilaments, and you know them to be like thick ones and thin ones. Here's a thin one, and here are some thick ones over here. Here's a pretty good illustration of a sarcomere. The endpoints are what we call a Z-disc. Maybe it was called a Z-disc because, you know, it's the endpoint of a sarcomere. Z is the endpoint of the letters in our language. Or maybe because it has a little zigzag pattern to it under certain kinds of observations, and so maybe somebody called that the Z-disc. Remember, it's a plate. It's just not a line, but in three dimensions, it's a plate. And you should certainly remember what protein is attached to the Z-disc. And your choices would be actin or myosin. And you should just see, well, it is the thin one, so it's actin attached to the Z-disc. And what about myosin? Is myosin attached to the Z-disc? It is not, right? It is separated from the Z-disc when the sarcomere is not contracting, but it is connected to, okay, it is connected to these proteins right here that are in the very center of the sarcomere. So these myosin molecules can't just float around. They are anchored within the sarcomere. You see some bumps on the myosin molecule. You don't see any bumps on the actin molecule. And at this particular picture, these bumps don't reach up and touch the actin. So in this particular case, this sarcomere is relaxed, right? Because there is no connection between myosin and actin. What else do we want to recognize on this slide? Well, there are some dark bands and light bands. Here is the dark band that is the whole extent of the myosin filament. And the light bands are where you don't have myosin filaments. All right, so this is just a review from anatomy. You definitely have to know what the A band is, right, and what the I band is. And it's actually really easy to remember, right, that this is the dark band, right, or that the dark band is the A band because, not how it was named, but because there's an A in A band and there's an A in dark, right? There's an I in I band and there's an I in light. So that matches up pretty nicely. All right, so the question I have for you, so here's a nice illustration of a sarcomere. This, I'm sure, is an exam figure. All right, so here's the M line. That's the center point for every myosin molecule. One characteristic of skeletal muscle is that if you stretch it out and let go, okay, not contracting the muscle, but if you stretch it out and let go, what's going to happen to that muscle? It's going to go back to its original length. And that's because it has what kind of properties? What kind of protein? Is it that you can stretch and when you let go it goes back? Elastic. Yeah, it has elastic properties. And so I see a titin filament. Titin is an elastic protein. It's not fair to shorten the muscle in the sense that it can't produce power for shortening. It only works when you stretch a muscle to get it back to its original length. That titin molecule can't really make a muscle go shorter to pull bones together, right? It can take up slack. All right, so the titin molecule is not really important for contraction. It's only important for elastic recoil. And so that means that the myosin and actin molecule are important for contraction. So I got actin and myosin. Let me look at the next slide. The question is, how does this sarcomere shorten? So this Z disc is going to get closer to this one over here. How does that happen? And we just said it's not because of titin. It's because of actin and myosin. So my question is, which one of these proteins shortens when the sarcomere shortens? Is it the actin molecule that gets shorter, or is it the myosin? Or I suppose there's another possibility. Maybe they both shorten. So how would you describe or explain to somebody how a sarcomere gets shorter? Okay. Oh, somebody said, well, maybe it's not shortening of either one of them. Is that possible? Which one do you think shortens? Or both, one, the other, or neither? Okay. I think in anatomy we realized, or you learned, that it's neither. So how is it that these Z discs get closer together if neither the actin nor the myosin can get shorter? And that's because if we look at that arrangement right there, we see that they are interdigitated, right? There's one next to the other, and this pattern just repeats itself over and over and over again. So here I have a couple markers. I'll turn on the lights real quick, see if we get any weird feedback. I think we're pretty good here. Okay, so can you see these markers right here? I got a black one and I think a red one. Okay, so the red one we'll call myosin. Black one we're going to call actin. All right, so the question is, which ones of these two shorten, right, because they're in a sarcomere, which ones of these shorten to bring the Z-discs together? Well, let's just say that my hands are the Z-discs. We'll make it a little bit simplified. I only have one actin and one myosin. Okay, we put them together like that. And which one is going to shorten in order for these Z-discs to come closer together? Black one. Okay, the black one gets shorter, then the Z-disc is going to come over here. Okay, but, you know, we're stuck with these markers right here. I can't really change the length of either of these markers. Okay, so they don't get shorter. So how can we think about, what's another way to think about how do these Z-discs get closer together if neither of these markers can shorten? Well, there can be association to where they slide over each other. Now my hands are closer together, but what about the markers? Are they still the same length? They haven't changed their length at all. They're still the same length, but my hands are closer together. So a sarcomere does get shorter, but neither myosin or actin get shorter. They do what? They slide over each other. So we call that the sliding filament mechanism. Okay, and guess what? That's theory. That's not just a hypothesis. That's pretty much how it happens. And so we got to look next time to see how that happens. And we're going to look at some proteins inside the cell. If you want to read ahead a little bit, not only do we have to know about myosin and actin, but we're going to have to learn something about troponin, tropomyosin, some of these head groups that can form a cross bridge. ATP is necessary. So these things we never talked about in anatomy, right? Troponin, tropomyosin. And there's also going to be something important that allows this to happen, and it's the reason why we get osteoporosis. There's one explanation why we get osteoporosis. So the signaling compound, signaling molecule that allows these things to slide over each other is calcium. Okay? So calcium is going to be important. Calcium, tropomyosin, troponin, okay, this ATPase on the myosin tail, a myosin head group, and then we'll see how that muscle actually shortens. If it is striated muscle. What kind of muscles are striated? Skeletal and cardiac. So skeletal and cardiac muscle has this kind of machinery to shorten. Smooth muscle has a different kind of machine. We'll look at that next time too. Okay. Sign-in sheet is going around somewhere. And in Blackboard, there's some really good animations. I'll try to show you an animation next time, but look in Blackboard at the animations for this sliding filament mechanism next time.